The semi-annual warehouse clearance event is happening now at Sleep Outfitters. This is your chance to save big with up to 65% off mattresses store-wide. Plus, get a free adjustable base with select Sealy mattresses. These limited-time warehouse clearance deals won't last, and with our lifetime price guarantee, you can rest assured you're getting the best deal. The semi-annual warehouse clearance event, only at Sleep Outfitters. Visit sleepoutfitters.com to find a store near you.
This week, we light the fuse, spelled interestingly F-U-Z-E, with that film's star and director Aaron Taylor-Johnson and David McKenzie. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast. I cannot wait for Easter this weekend, because you know what that means. Eggs in the fridge, baby. Chilled chocolate being smashed from a great height. Oh, yes, indeed. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined in the pod booth by Geek Queen Helen O'Hara. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Fantastic. And, you know, honestly, I was planning on stringing out the search for James Dyer's nickname, or honorific, more accurately, for a full year. I was prepared to do this every week for a whole year, asking listeners for suggestions for what Jimbo should be called on this show. And then we were going to get to the very last podcast of the year. And whatever that one was, I was going to go, that's it. That's your new nickname. And then immediately discard it and just call you something else the next year. But we think we stumbled upon it, right, Jimbo? James Dyer is here, everybody, in case you don't know who that is. We think we stumbled upon it. Last week, it was suggested the Mad Titan, which you quite like.
I'm taking it.
And yeah. I quite like.
Because you've refused to sing my name in the Dune style every week, yes, which I think is lazy.
It's good for the ears of our listeners. But believe you me, I don't think that's a good idea. But people are still sending in your nickname suggestions, Jimbo. But I think we found it.
Is it like, hey, like I'm gonna reserve that. So like Super Smashing Lovely Great, your money is safe.
Oh, sorry, where are you from? What is happening? What the hell is happening?
What? I've just got a bit bullseye. It's fine.
A bit bullseye.
A little bit.
Like several hundred miles to the south of bullseye.
Bullseye or bullseye?
Who really knows where it's filmed? So I'm going to reserve that nickname. And then if a better one comes along, I can swap it out.
Okay. All right.
That doesn't sound fair.
That means, do I still have to do this every week now?
No.
Okay.
Just if something really good comes
in. If something really good comes along, feel free to suggest it so that I can reject it.
All right, well, because someone has literally just sent in one, Rico Siwokas on Blue Sky. Why not simply refer to him as our resident face hugger? I don't know. That doesn't paint you in the greatest light.
No, that makes him sound more affectionate than he is.
It also feels like it might be an HR issue. So yeah. I think let's leave that.
James, I've known you for a long, long time now. You have never hugged my face.
That is true.
Have we ever hugged?
I don't think so.
I think you must have.
I feel the sexual tension is too high. I feel it would be dangerous, Chris, for both of us. So I'm going to say no.
And everyone in the vicinity
right,
as well.
Yeah.
Helen, have we ever hugged?
I'm pretty sure there was that one time.
Yeah.
Oh, my wedding.
That one time, they were drunk.
Your wedding. I don't know.
My wedding, Helen's wedding, everyone's weddings. Have you and James ever hugged?
It seems unlikely.
This feels like something we can facilitate by the end of the show.
Of weird group hug.
We are triangulated at the moment, but I think we can get you two closer for just a friendly hug by the end of it. Yeah, no sexual
threat
tension.
Threat or a promise? It's really unclear.
I mean, it kind of speaks volumes of the fact that we are sat in the studio and Helen and I are as far away as the desk allows.
But as the contract demands.
Yes.
Our lawyers have been very clear on this.
I cannot be within 6 feet of Helen.
I have to swivel. I'm on a pivot right now, talking to Helen and James for this. All right. I like the Mad Titan. I'll be honest with you.
Sold.
Yeah, best laid plans of mice and men and all that, and have been completely scuttled by the... And I don't even know who sent it in.
I am inevitable.
You are? Well, I guess that is depressingly true.
Yeah. I don't know very many sane titans in sort of literary history.
That's true, but, you know, you are the geek queen. He is the mad titan.
That's fair.
Let's call the whole thing off. Anyway, speaking of sexual tension, Helen and I had another theatre date the other day.
Yes, we did.
Yes, we did. Yes, we went to see The Producers.
The Producers.
Oh, Bullseye again. Nice.
Oh, my God. super smashing great. I can't do Ronnie Corbett doing anything other than The Producers. And I can barely do him doing that. So we went to see The Producers. Richard Kind, the legendary Richard Kind.
Amazing.
Bing Bong himself, the star of The Producers. He's on for a 7-week run as Max Bialystock in that show, based, of course, on the Bell Brooks film. Amazing. I hadn't seen it before. It's so much fun. He was in the pod booth about an hour ago. And that'll be on, I think, next week's show or an episode of The Interviews. But he was an absolute delight. And hell's bells, he was a delight on stage as well.
He really was. To quote the show itself, he can do it.
He can do it. He can sing all the songs that he likes.
Yeah, he was absolutely sensational. The thought of doing that at just, what, 8 times a week in your 70s, I don't know how he does it. He must live on Red Bull and other energy drinks.
Yeah.
Astonishing. It's also just a fantastic funny production. I mean, we've both seen the film. I think we've all seen the film.
Have I seen The Producers? Do you know what? I'm not entirely sure that I have.
I think it might be that rare comedy
that cuts through.
It seems doubtful.
Jimbo, you were invited. You were invited.
That's true. This time, I was invited.
You were invited.
Yes. Yeah.
And you
I chose not to come because I thought I'd be bored.
I don't think he would have been.
No, I beg to differ.
I don't think he would have been.
How could you be bored with Richard Kind in the room?
Yeah. Singing about Hitler.
Exactly. And Broadway.
Yeah.
What theatre was it?
The Garrick.
Mm.
What's the leg room like?
Decent.
It was all right, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Ice creams at halftime.
Ice cream.
Oh my God, we're old. Oh my God.
See, in our listenership, there's 5 or 6 middle-aged men chortling to themselves at that, and everyone else is like, what the fuck are they talking about?
I'm like, what the fuck? And I thought I was...
Helen, you are not a middle-aged man.
No, although I will say, were your husband here, he would be smoking.
Would he?
Yes.
Smoking?
He might be smoking. He would be smoking.
I've seen your husband. He's smoking.
Thanks very much. But wait, so this was big in Italy, whatever you're referring to? What are you referring to?
Hang on, are you referring to your husband?
He may well be big in Italy.
Oh, my word.
Oh, boy.
It was big in video games.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
In the early 90s.
Oh. Speedball 2.
Mm.
Like Super Mario or something.
Yes. A little bit like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, go see The Producers. It is playing right now with Richard Kind. I think you got 5 more weeks of Richard Kind, and Andy Nyman returns to play Max Bialystock. But it is terrific.
Really
good. One of the best times I've had in the theatre in a long time. Shall we have a question?
Yes, please.
Is it egg-related?
It's Easter-related.
Oh.
We have several Easter-related questions. I asked Blue Sky this week for the questions, and a lot of people have responded kind of like a hive mind. Like a hive mind. So a lot of people have asked the best film featuring an egg.
Aliens.
It's an open goal for this man, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it was always going to be that, wasn't it?
Yeah. Cool Hand Luke, all that sort of stuff. Some people have focused on the concept of resurrection.
Mm.
Alien resurrection.
Oh, because boy. You don't even think that. Come on.
I'm begging you to see more films.
Shan't, can't, won't.
But preferably don't have the word alien in the title. Die Hard. Okay. That'll do it. Please. Some people have asked, best character return from the dead in film. That's from Andy Cameron, David Heslop, Mount Rushmore. No, we're not doing one so soon. Of characters who came back from the dead. And someone else, Paul Meller. What's your favorite resurrection from a movie? Any genre. So a character who died and then got better. Any ideas?
Well, that immediately says Trev Chelios to me.
Trev Chelios. He was brown bread.
He was brown bread.
Yeah.
And then he got better.
He did.
Twice.
Yeah. He does kind of die at the end of the second one as well. Spoiler alert. For Crank 2, in case you don't know what we're talking about. Because I realised last week we have an annoying habit of just saying character names, not saying what film they're from. I think I'm stuck like this for the rest of the show.
You might be. That's a good shout. Although, you know, because he doesn't actually I guess he does get shocked back to life, so I guess he technically does die, but...
Well, it depends.
It's Jeff Chillios, he's proper dead.
Yeah, but this is discussed, isn't it, in some of the Final Destination movies. Like, are we talking brainstem death, you know, or is it just his heart stopped for a minute?
Yeah.
Was he, like, all the way dead, or was he only mostly dead, like in The Princess Bride, which is the right answer to this question?
Oh, God, I'm begging you, see more films, honestly.
All right, Gandalf.
Will anyone go to bat for either of the flatliners?
No.
No?
No.
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 No. Definitely not the second flatliners. I mean, who's going to bat for that?
Well, my...
You have to see it in order to go for it.
Yeah. And I haven't. My off-the-top-of-my-head resurrection film would probably be Alex Proyas' The Crow.
Okay.
In which Brandon Lee's Eric Draven returns from the dead as a vengeful revenant.
But isn't he, like, kind of not... alive? Like, isn't he somewhat undead? Like, he's
figure?
Like, he's brought back by a psychopomp who will then
a psychopomp, you know.
The crows are psychopomps.
What is a psychopomp?
Psychopomps are the things that take you to the afterlife.
They guide you back from the netherworld.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I've never heard that before. I thought you meant like you know, like a parade, but like a particularly mad one.
Psychopomps. Yeah. The in Stephen King's The Dark Half.
Yeah.
You know, the motif that repeats all the way through that is the sparrows are flying again, and the sparrows are psychopomps who are there to take George Stark.
Oh, that's good. I like this. I've learned a new word.
Yeah.
But yes, the crow is a psychopomp, and and it ushers him back from the land of the dead so that he can beat people up.
Yes.
Yeah, is he fully alive? You know, like, he comes back.
Are any
like,
of us fully alive, Helen?
Can people see him and interact with him?
Yes.
I guess so. Okay.
Then therefore he is alive.
Yeah, but need he sleep or eat? You know, is he fully, like, corporeal, I guess?
He's definitely corporeal because he punches people in the face.
Does he have the same, or is he more of a lieutenant? Or is he just corporeal? Does he go, woo? Because that's how you tell a ghost.
Not generally.
Okay,
no,
well, therefore, he's not a ghost.
No. Yeah.
A ghost would go, woo.
They would.
Wow.
They would go, woo.
I don't think you've watched more horror movies than that, Chris, but okay.
I've seen Evil Dead too. I'm begging me. See more films.
Better films. Yeah.
Shut the fuck up.
I said Gandalf and everybody ignored me.
That's true.
I didn't ignore you. I thought you were calling me Gandalf and I was vaguely insulted.
Hashtag Gandalf so white.
Yeah.
Gandalf, that's a good shout. He falls through the bowels of the earth and turns up in the sky.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So maybe Gandalf. But another one that James will like because it's one of the other three films he's seen.
Ridley.
Spock.
Spock.
Yes.
I mean, how was that not our first answer?
How was it not?
Because one of the all-time great deaths, like, he is definitely dead. He is all the way dead.
Yeah.
He is put in a torpedo.
Is that a Princess Bride quote, all the way dead?
No, not really.
Okay, this is just something you like? You like to say all the way dead?
Inconceivable.
I mean, I don't remember I've said it much before.
You've said it about 14 times in the last 10 minutes. So I'm curious to know where it came from, because I like it. All the way dead, 100% dead.
I guess it's, I'm contrasting it to, like, mostly dead. But, you know, but I do have questions about some of these characters, given... You know, that Final Destination film.
Spock is definitely
Spock
dead.
Spock is
all
is
the way dead.
Definitely dead. Like, he is extinct. He is an ex-Spock.
He is a green-blooded, cold-blooded creature because the blood ain't flowing anymore through his body. He makes that heart-wrenching sacrifice at the end of The Wrath of Khan. You have been and always shall be my friend. Super smashing great. Look what you could have won.
That's a little bit like if Robert De Niro had played Spock, wasn't it?
You always
will be.
No one can do De Niro's voice.
Not even him.
You just go, yo.
Yo, yo,
yo,
yo. I'm going to add The Matrix to the mix. For
Matrix.
Neo does snuff it towards the end and then is magically resurrected. He's the one.
Yeah. Is he cloned, do we think? Like, how is he resurrected?
No. Well, he just essentially comes back, doesn't he? Because he's dead. He's flatlined.
She rescues him. Trinity rescues him.
That's true.
Yes, and she whispers sweet nothings in his ear. And then suddenly, he's beginning to believe.
Okay, that makes sense. I was thinking of, like, later in the Matrix series, I guess.
Yeah. Medically, when he gets his eyes put out. Yeah.
Medically, does that work?
Well, speaking to someone and getting them to come back.
Yeah.
Yeah. In absolutely. In The Matrix, it does.
You know where else it happens?
Where?
Dune! Part two, when Paul drinks the water of life and dies, and then it takes Chani's tears to bring him back. Chani!
Does he die? Does he actually die? Does he cark it? Is he all the way dead?
He's all the way dead.
Yeah. I think he's only mostly dead.
Mostly dead. He's definitely partly dead.
All right. Can we talk a bit more about Spock's resurrection?
Yeah, well, he's kind of actually just... Like, his cells are essentially reactivated from birth on an accelerated timeline the Genesis device. Yes. And then his...
Buried alive!
No, he's just... Well, he's...
Well, technically he is, right?
I guess. But he gets out of the torpedo shell pretty quickly. So anyway, then he's running around on the Genesis planet. Spoilers for...
And Christopher Lloyd turns up.
Star Trek 3, I guess. And then he gets his entire mind put back in his head... through some ritualistic practices and the contrivance of bones.
Hang on.
So his entire mentality has been transferred into the mind of his good buddy Bones.
Right.
And then it's transferred back into the now fresh and empty mind of his clone.
So that's a clone that's growing on the Genesis planet.
Yeah.
In Star Trek 3.
He backs up his brain, like with Norton.
Yeah.
He backs up his brain into Dr. McCoy, and then he re-downloads it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is totally a thing that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, they kind of set it up in Wrath of Khan, don't they? Because he renders Bones unconscious. He goes,
yes. And he goes, remember.
Hey, you remember. He does that, doesn't
he? That's exactly what he says.
That's exactly. So is that a good resurrection? It's a great death. I'm not so sure that it's a good resurrection. I mean, let's be honest. It's an odd-numbered Star Trek.
True.
And we know what that means.
I do think... Yeah, you're right. It's definitely a better death and a resurrection. What I will say for the resurrection bit is they do take their time over it. You know, they give it a full movie kind of justifying bringing him back. Do they justify it? No, probably not. But, you know, they give it some weight at least. They give it some pretense at thought.
It's one of the better odd-numbered Treks, so...
Yes.
It's not an abomination.
Catwoman.
Oh, my God. God,
she's not proper dead.
Michelle Pfeiffer, Catwoman.
She's not proper dead.
She's
thrown from like a skyscraper.
Yeah, but she lands in the snow.
She gets catted back to life.
Yeah, she gets licked better.
She lands on her feet.
That's less ridiculous than Trinity whispering sweet nothings into Neo's ear, and suddenly he's like, "Oh, I know, I'm back," or whatever he says. Yeah.
That's definitely what he says.
Wow. I'm back.
Oh, for talking cats, Aslan.
Aslan.
Yeah.
It's not Aslan. It's
not
a porn version.
It's Aslan.
Good Lord.
Lord Almighty.
I mean, if we're getting into some serious, you know, Jesus analogies at that point, aren't we?
I mean, it's Easter. It's Easter, Helen. It's the time of miracles.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say, I'm disappointed in both of you, quite frankly, that neither of you have gone for a Jesus.
Really?
Yeah.
You think we should have gone for a Jesus? Just any Jesus?
Yeah. It is... about best resurrections and who resurrected better than Jesus Christ on film many, many times by many, many wonderful people. No love for Jeffrey Hunter, the original Captain Pike in The Robe?
No love for The Robe, no.
No? No love for Jim Caviezel in The Passion of the Christ?
No, but I love him in The Thin Red Line. Do I get points for that?
Not really.
Sure, why not? Okay. All right, so we haven't mentioned two of our favorite franchises of all time, Super Mario and the MCU.
Wow.
And Star Wars. Does anyone get resurrected in Star Wars? Ben is, that's a gray area, right? Because
he doesn't get resurrected. He's just dead. He's just a ghost.
Has anyone been resurrected? Has anyone died
somehow
and then got better?
Palpatine returned.
That's not a good resurrection, though. That's a bad resurrection.
It's a terrible resurrection.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes Trinity whispering in Neo's ear like seem medically sound. somehow Palpatine returned.
It's the biggest shoulder shrug and hand wave ever. So
somehow,
he's back.
Like, you know, it happened.
Ooh, the abyss.
Yes, you've never fought for anything in your life. Now fight! That's good.
That is a good one.
You've never quit in your life, isn't it?
Is it?
You've never quit on anything in your life.
Okay. It's been a long time. I said fought for anything.
Oh, no.
She's fought for everything.
Never negative.
Never misquoted
Harris. Even if she's dying, he's negging her. It's like, why would she want to come back to that? You're just negging me. No, he's like, you'd never quit on anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's fair. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I've just misquoted James Cameron. That's upsetting.
Oh, my God. He's going to come for you.
He's going to come for me.
Yeah. Yeah, so Star Wars, no one's really properly come back, have they? That's disappointing.
We must be forgetting somebody. There must have been.
Someone's going to write in. There's going to be someone in an episode of the Blah Blah who who died in one episode and then was resurrected three episodes later. Before we talk about the MCU, because there's quite a few resurrections in the MCU, I learned this week, I'm sure we knew this already, but I was reminded this week that in Solo, there's a brief appearance from Darth Maul, who obviously, there's a new Maul series coming to Disney Plus.
Shadow Lord.
And Maul appears in Solo, the movie Solo.
He does.
And he's played by Ray Park, Jr. And he's voiced by Sam Witwer.
Yes.
Now, I learned this week that Peter Serafinowicz, the original voice of Darth Maul, recorded those lines that movie. Yes, Peter Serafinowicz said this week he was on set, just hanging out, just checking some stuff. He was never actually Maul, and then he recorded the lines, and then they called him up and said, actually, we're going with Sam Witwer as the official voice of Maul from now on. Now, this may upset some people because I know that Sam Witwer is beloved in the Star Wars community, but he's just doing a Peter Serafinowicz impression, isn't he? So why wouldn't you just go with the original and best? Serafinowicz's Darth Maul is incredible.
I kind of get it because Witwer is now Maul in everything, so it makes sense consistently. But also I would say that the Maul in Solo is more consistent with the Witwer Maul than the Phantom Menace Maul. So.
Helen, do you have any opinions on this? Any earth-shattering revelations you would care to share with us?
I just think he should have stayed dead. He was cut in half. That should mean something.
Sorry. Maul was resurrected.
It all came full circle.
Yes, Maul was resurrected.
I thought that's why you were talking about
it. No, he was literally cut in twain.
Why?
Yeah.
Oh.
And then the twain shall meet, and then he's back.
He got better.
Yes. Oh, my God. Look at us stumbling upon a right answer.
So what about the MCU? Because
what
about
the MCU?
Generally speaking, we want the deaths to mean something, but like a whole ton of people done died and come back.
They have.
Who do we like? Like Doctor Strange, for example.
Doctor Strange.
Died a bunch, but not long enough for us to notice.
Yeah.
Dormammu.
Yeah, that's true. Groot died.
Lots of people. I mean, this was something. Yeah. This was something that was a stick used very early on to beat the MCU with, because many people died and then came back almost instantly.
Well, half the whole universe died.
Yeah, that's true.
This is true. Yeah. So if we start listing,
it could take a while.
But right from the off, people were carking it and then coming back. Like Coulson died, and then he comes back in his TV show. If you never watched Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and God knows, nobody did. Then you'd be forgiven for thinking that he's dead in the MCU because he has not been in an MCU film post Avengers. It takes place post Avengers, more accurately, because I know he's in Captain Marvel. But yeah, Coulson was one. Pepper Potts, kind of dies in Iron Man 3 and then comes back 5 minutes later. So it's when people, deaths actually start to stick, like Quicksilver, who's still not back 12 years after Age of Ultron, 11 years after Age
of
Ultron.
Any minute now, don't worry.
Yeah.
Any minute now.
He's famously slow.
Yes. that was a good thing. That was a good thing that these deaths stuck.
Death should matter.
Death should matter.
Except if you're only mostly dead, in which case Miracle Max should be able to fix you.
Yes, but if you're all the way dead, good luck with that. You might need a psycho pump to bring you back from the grave. Anyway, there we go. I think we have successfully answered that question to almost nobody's satisfaction, which is good.
Great.
Shall we take a little break? Just in case someone has sponsored the show this week? Let's do it, shall we?
All right.
I hope there were ads.
There may not have been ads. Can I drop in an ad now? I'm going to do an ad.
God, what's
See, I know what you think. You think that I'm about to plug the Pilot TV podcast.
And I'm right.
And say something like, I get to spoke to the English language well on the Pilot TV podcast.
You fell English? That's impossible.
Noah Wiley and Catherine Lanasa for The Pit.
Ooh.
Where? Chatting to me. It was very exciting. But that's not what I want to advertise.
Are you being sponsored by someone? What's going on?
I want to advertise the Empire Spoiler Special podcast, which you can now subscribe to at empirespoilerspecials.com. We have a brand new URL that points directly to the page, so I don't have to go. I don't have to go empire.supportingcast.fm, blah, blah, blah. It's just empirespoilerspecials.com. And for just $3.49 a month, you can have many, many wonderful spoilers in your ears.
Fantastic. Great. This sounds great, James. Tell us more about this, these spoiler specials.
Well, you can hear us talking about the latest series of Daredevil Born Again, which is a TV show, and you'd expect that to be on the Pilot TV podcast, wouldn't you, Chris?
No.
And yet, here we are.
Yes.
But you can also subscribe to Pilot Plus at pilottvpod.com.
Pilot TV Pod.
Yes, I've been on a domain name shopping spree.
Have you?
Yes.
How much did you spend? Millions, no
millions, doubt. Millions of pounds on each of them. Yeah, I really splashed out.
Wow, excellent. Good stuff. What's it again?
EmpireSpoilerSpecials.com.
EmpireSpoilerSpecials.com.
Or PilotTVPod.com.
EmpireSpoilerSpecials.com.
Yes.
.com. This is a better work. Hey, look at that. It works.
Look at that.
And this week, our Project Hail Mary spoiler special with Lord Miller went up. Our Ready or Not, Here I Come spoiler special with Tyler Gillette and Matt Bettinelli Open went up. Another Daredevil spoiler special went up. Next week, Peaky Blinders. Oh, my God. Our spoiler cup overfloweth. £3.49 a month. Can't say fairer than that. All right, shall we delve deep into the world of movie news? Now, we should say we're recording this on a Wednesday because of Good Friday. So, has anything happened?
There was a Supergirl trailer. Ooh. Another Supergirl trailer.
But a more full one this
A more fully rounded Supergirl trailer.
With a plot, with an idea of the plot.
Right,
as well.
Yeah. And with a lot of Lobo. Or a medium amount of Lobo. Enough Lobo that I want to see Jason Momoa's Lobo. I am cautiously optimistic about this film.
Wow.
And I hated Superman with the Fire of 1,000 Yellow Suns.
Really? You've never mentioned this.
But this, like I say, Superman was both silly and stupid. But this film, I think, embraces the silliness in a way that I think is going to work better. And I think maybe that tonality lends itself to this story better. And it has a Guardians vibe to it. I don't know. There's something about this that I genuinely want to see it. So I'm feeling, as I say, cautiously optimistic.
Wow, this has really turned you around. Okay, what is that story, Helen?
This is actually based on one of the comics, the Supergirl Women of Tomorrow, and it's kind of True Grit with Supergirl as the Rooster Cogburn character. So, you know, you look at Millie Alcock, who plays Supergirl, of course, and you think John Wayne.
You do.
You know, you think Jeff Bridges. It's a natural sort of follow-on from that. So basically, a younger girl asks her for help in avenging her family, and it so happens that the person who killed her family, which is kind of not really dealt with in this trailer, is also the person who poisoned Supergirl's beloved dog, Crypto. Which we do see in this trailer.
We do.
So she has to go after this person who is Krem of the Yellow Hills. Played by Matthias Schoenaerts, to get the antidote to save Crypto and generally, you know, put things right that once went wrong.
Yeah.
And along the way, yes, meets Lobo.
I still find Crypto a bit upsetting.
But I don't want to see him
poisoned.
Crypto in this one.
I'm very anti CG dogs.
Oh, I know.
Dogs, yes. CG dogs,
no to CG dogs.
James cheered whenever the dog was poisoned at the beginning of the trailer. He was like, yes.
So this is all directed by Craig Gillespie.
Yeah.
And it's got a little bit of a Guardians vibe. I absolutely agree on that. I think it has a little bit almost of a Red Dwarf vibe at times, weirdly.
What?
Yeah, just a bit of kind of that kind of grungy space weirdness. I think it's grungier.
I did not get that at all because the sets didn't largely look made
of cardboard. Yeah.
No, I'm not saying that the effects are made of cardboard. I'm just saying that there's something about the color scheme, really.
If it does have a bit of Red Dwarf DNA, I'm going to like it even more. So, you know.
I'm hopeful for it. I'm really, really optimistic that it's going to be good. The comic is actually a really good comic. Highly recommend picking up Women of Tomorrow if you haven't already. Cast all look really good here. We get a little bit this time of David Krumholtz as her dad. I'm excited.
There was another trailer out this week for Masters of the Universe, Travis Knight's adaptation of He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, of course. The first trailer was interesting. It had a kind of Thor Ragnarok-y vibe to it. It was quite glib, quite knowing, quite witty. This one seems to have jettisoned that tone, which I hope isn't an indication for the film.
Yeah, no, it's still there in the almost, you know, the way they're almost doing a post-credit sting on trailers now. Like, it's still there in that bit, but the rest of the trailer is very much emphasizing, you know, Prince Adam's Nicholas Galitzin, obviously taking that role, his kind of disillusionment or his feelings of alienation, having been exiled from his home and growing up on Earth and always knowing that something is wrong and not being able to sort of quite express why always, certainly not openly, because then people thought he was cuckoo. So I think they're leaning more into the kind of, there is an emotional heart to this film. There is the nub of something real here. It's not just a dude with improbable muscles waving a sword around at a skeleton. And we get to hear Skeletor's English accent here, which is a thing that's also happening, and see a little bit more of the supporting cast, a little bit more of, you know, Idris Elba's man at arms, right?
Man at arms. Yeah.
And Evil Lyn gets a little, she doesn't get much to do.
Spoiler, she's not a goodie.
What?
Yeah.
I mean, nominative determinism strikes again for Alison Brie, my goodness. So, like, it looks like a He-Man movie.
This is, I think, I'm not going to say wrong-headed. It has less personality than the teaser. I think the teaser felt poppy and zippy and full of fun. This one takes itself a little more seriously than I would like, because I feel like the film is going to be fun.
Yeah.
And this feels like they're leaning into the kind of action-adventure aspects rather than the fun aspects and the nostalgia aspects, which I personally wouldn't have done. But you know what? Cover your bases. It's all good. As long as the film's fine, I don't mind.
Yeah. Well, let's hope for some... A bit of everything, a bit more than just nostalgia, though. Like, everything doesn't need to be based in the 80s, I'm just saying. Anyway, moving on, whatever. Hey, there was also a trailer for Back Rooms.
There was.
The weirdy, freaky, you
creepy
know.
Pasta type-y creepy thing.
Pasta type thing.
Creepy
pasta, A24, Chiwetel Ejiofor.
It's weird and cool and creepy and scary, and I like it.
Do you know what it reminds me of? And you're going to laugh at me or think I've gone mad, but it actually reminds me of some of the Terry Pratchett ideas of things that are, you know, weird and bizarre and prey on, like, dimensions that prey on our dimension. You remember in that Terry Pratchett book where there's, like, little snow globes that, and then, like, shopping carts, and it's all sort of part of a weird other dimensional takeover that will turn our city, you know, Ankh-Morpork Pork into, like, a weird metropolis city. It feels like that kind of an idea. It feels like there's another dimension preying
another
on
dimension.
Ours. And it's sort of like mimicking our dimension, but imperfectly in a way that is deeply disturbing.
So we should say, so the plot of this is in, so Chiwetel Ejiofor works in is it a furniture showroom?
Looks like, like one of those slightly weird ones where you don't know why it's still open and who's
shopping
there.
At the back in the storeroom, there's a wall and you walk through the wall and it takes you into almost like a weird labyrinthine hinterland of like forgotten rooms which seem to go on ad infinitum and never ever end. Do you know what it put to mind for me? The Langoliers. You know the Stephen King story, The Langoliers?
Yeah.
This idea that there's like a forgotten reality that's left behind to kind of just sort of fester, and then these little Langoliers come and eat it all up. But this feels like a sub-reality that almost is like a storeroom for the leftover bits of our reality. Like, it's weird and surreal. People get trapped there. Nothing is quite what it seems. There's things hanging off the ceiling. Like, it's all a bit odd. And it comes from this internet meme, which, being, you know, young and hip, I definitely know really well.
Very, very much so, as do I. Anywho.
All right. Looks good. Sounds good. Hopefully good.
Yeah, I think it'll be freaking unsettling at least.
Yes,
yeah.
It looks probably creepy.
Yeah.
All right. Did either of you see, it's all teasers this week so far, but the teaser trailer for David Robert Mitchell's new film, the guy behind It Follows, who has made a new film that was at one point called Flowerfell Avenue and has now been renamed to The End of Oak Street. And it is about a family led by Anne Hathaway and Ewan McGregor, who's, speaking of another dimension, whose house in Oak Street, and in fact it seems Oak Street itself, seems to somehow get transported to another world.
Yeah.
A world in which dinosaurs run rife.
Yeah.
Sounds Twilight Zone-y and weird and creepy, but also pretty epic also.
It felt to me like it had a very not quite young skewing, but young friendly tone to it. Do you know what I mean? Like, it didn't feel like it was this was going to be like a horror scary film. It felt like this was going to be a kind of an action adventure family ish film. Did you get that vibe from the trailer?
A little bit, but I'm still a bit unsettled by it. I do feel like there's a bit of a mini trend for family homes becoming, you know, being put somewhere or families being imperiled by that. There's, I think, a Netflix film coming up where a family are sort of trapped in their home and don't know why, but then, you know, they only have so much water and food and what happens next and what do you do and blah, blah, blah.
Do you think these are all scripts that were conceived during COVID by any chance?
I mean, possibly, yeah. But I don't know. There may be a mini sort of a renaissance of such one location kind of horrors coming up. I mean, Undertone, even in a few weeks, the podcast horror has a similar sort of one location vibe.
Podcast horror?
I know. It seems so far-fetched. Mm. Nothing bad could happen in a podcast. Dun, ow, dun, dun. My finger.
Helen is now mostly dead. She may graduate to being all the way dead by the end of the episode. We will keep you updated, of course, on that. But this looks good. Mm. I thought it looked good.
Very much so.
Yeah. Controversial opinion. All right, so here's interesting news. Scream 7, of course, mm-hmm. has been huge at the box office. It is going to be the biggest film in the Scream franchise, and by no little distance as well. So naturally, they decided to end the franchise there. They said, we're done. We've hit the heights.
We don't want more money.
Leave them wanting more. We don't want to give them any more. No, of course not. They're doing Scream 8. Scream 8 is on its way, even as we speak. They do turn these things around pretty damn quickly. And Lilla and Nora Zuckerman, who were showrunners on Poker Face, are going to write this. Mm. They're going to write this movie. I don't know yet who's directing it, whether Kevin Williamson will return to direct this. I guess they're going to wait and see what happens, right?
Yeah, I would assume so. The Zuckermans also wrote the Buffy pilot that was cruelly cancelled before we could see where it was going to lead recently. So they're obviously so hot right now, frankly, and fingers crossed that this will be a good Scream, I guess.
I believe they will be the first women to write a Scream. Now, that might shake things up. That might make things interesting. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Perhaps I shall catch up on the last five or so films before it comes out.
Oh, boy. Did we also see that Ryan Gosling is going to be starring in the Daniels new film?
Yes, we did see that.
Oh. Well,
but we didn't say it.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yes.
Hey, Ryan Gosling is going to be starring in the new film from the Daniels.
Is he? Tell us more.
Well, I don't really have very much more, but I'm excited about that.
Do we know what it's called?
It's going to start shooting in LA later this summer. It's still wrapped in secrecy. The plot is under lock and key.
Uh-huh.
It may be, according to a Collider interview with Daniel Kwan, a fun sci-fi action comedy with a big heart, very existential.
Right.
Project Hail Mary 2. That's what I'm saying. I'm just sticking to that.
Well, amaze.
Well, this is interesting because they have talked. There's been rumors and rumblings because Project Hail Mary is doing incredibly well at the box office. It had a bigger than expected opening, stop it. And it's done really, really well. It's got a lovely hold in the second weekend. And there have been rumblings that there might be a sequel, that there could be potential for a sequel. I really, really hope there isn't.
So do I.
Yeah, me too.
That's a terrible idea.
I wouldn't say terrible.
It's fairly terrible.
In an infinite universe, all things are possible. It could be that there is a great sequel to be had, but at the moment it feels perfect just as it is.
Yes. Yeah. Take a leaf out of Spyglass's book and just leave it alone. They Scream 7, we're stopping there. That's what you need to do.
Chris, no.
You need to stop there. Unless, of course, you have a resurrection.
Hey.
Oh. Yay. Yeah, I don't want another Project Hail Mary because I don't see what could the story be? But let's not speculate in case we spoil the film for people who haven't seen the first one yet. But I just don't know what the story could be. But then again, I'm not paid to come up with a story. I guess it's Andy Weir and Drew Goddard and Lorda Miller. Mm-hmm. That's on them. But it's really interesting how that's done so well at the box office and the Scream thing as well. Scream 7 becoming the biggest installment in that franchise. I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
Because it's not as good as Screams 5 and 6. Now, they've been going up, so there's a lot of interest clearly in this franchise. But it's interesting to me that Radio Silence, Matt Bettinelli, Ulpin, and Tyler Gillette didn't direct Scream 7. And then the movie they directed instead of Scream 7, Ready or Not 2, comes out a couple of weeks after Scream 7 and doesn't do remotely as well.
Yeah.
And there's like a sliding doors moment maybe going on here. But it's just fascinating to me in terms of horror at the box office right now, because something like Scream 7 hits really big comparatively.
Mm.
And yet other films like Ready or Not and They Will Kill You are kind of failure. Absolutely stumbling.
Scream had a clearer run at cinemas, I think, and there was less maybe happening right then apart from, awardsy films that were a very different proposition for a Friday night. I think, the two more recent horrors have had to fight against, like, Project Hail Mary having unexpectedly brilliant success and really kind of sucking up a lot of the online energy and online excitement, maybe.
Usually a rising tide lifts all boats. Usually if something like a Project Hail Mary gets people into the cinemas in droves, they go, oh, okay, that screening sold out. What should we see while we're here? Let's go see this Ready or Not film. It's been getting pretty decent reviews. Not amazing reviews, but pretty good reviews. And it's a fun film. And it's just, it's interesting to me. Like, there's just like such a lottery at the moment. Like, Scream 7 is not that good. And yet it has really hit in a way that other films are just struggling to do so. For me, it's a complete lottery. Nobody knows anything.
Nobody does know anything, yeah. But, all the more reason to take risks, I guess.
Yes.
Try new things.
Although...
I know.
The lesson's not borne out, but the fact that the risks are not doing well.
Damn
and the seventh in a series.
But then Project Hail Mary is an original big budget sci-fi.
And its success surprises me. Not because it's not brilliant, because it is brilliant, but because it's a quite long, quite thinky, quite deliberately paced film.
Mm.
And, I'm thrilled to bits that it's done so well.
Me too.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else you want to talk about?
They've confirmed that John Hannah's back for The Mummy.
Yes!
Not Lee Cronin's The Mummy.
Speaking of Radio Silence.
Very different. Speaking of Radio Silence, indeed. I thought this was already confirmed, so I'll be honest, I was surprised it was news, but I'm delighted because it would be the lesser without him.
It would.
So
Jonathan! Heaven forfend that the film be in any way disappointing or boring.
Don't you come for The Mummy, all right? I know it's like off your favorites.
No, look, it's rule of averages. They will make a good one at some point, and this could be it. So
you are on thin ice.
Inside Helen, there are two wolves. Yeah. The one wolf asks for original content every week, and the other wolf goes, "You come for The Mummy reboot, and I will tear your eyes."
Is it going to be good? Probably not. Do I care right now? No. And also, in this house, we do not disrespect the 1999 film because it's really fun.
Is it though?
Yes, it is really, really lovely and wonderful.
All right. So, shall we have two lovely guests?
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Silence. shall we have Aaron Taylor-Johnson and David McKenzie?
Fantastic.
Let's do it. So, one is the star and one is the director of a brand new thriller, which is in cinemas from this week and will be on Sky Cinema in a couple of months' time. I'm guessing it is called Fuse, F-U-Z-E. That's unusual spelling. It is explained in the film. And what is the film? The film is a heist thriller in which an old, unexploded World War II bomb is discovered at a London building site. They dispatch Aaron Taylor-Johnson to defuse the bomb. Meanwhile, as this is all happening, the local area is being evacuated, all except for a group of ne'er-do-wells.
No.
Led by Theo James and Sam Worthington, who use this distraction to break into a bank and do a bank job. Will they be discovered? Will the bomb explode? What is happening? What is reality? All of these questions and more are explored, and some are answered in David McKenzie's Fuse, which we'll be discussing in a few minutes in the review section. But first, I went along and spoke to McKenzie and Taylor Johnson, who worked together before on The Outlaw King, which also starred Chris Pine. And we had a good old natter. Enjoy.
David, Aaron, welcome to the Emperor Podcast. How are you both? Amazing. Yeah, thanks for having us.
Very good. Yeah. This is a tough film to talk about, guys, because I can't talk about anything past the first 5 minutes. There are so many twists and turns. I don't want to give anything away.
Yeah.
We'll tiptoe carefully. Don't you worry. But I understand this is like a 15-year passion project for you, David.
Yeah, it is, actually, to be honest.
Yeah.
It was generated as an idea about that long ago. And then you know, Ben Hopkins is a friend and a great filmmaker in his own right. And I were sort of, you know, going to various film festivals and I kind of pitched the idea to him and said, what about doing this, you know, mashup of a bomb disposal movie and a heist movie? And it was kind of pretty much as basic as that. And then Ben ran with the ball and wrote the script. And then, you know, I got busy and made some films, you know, and you know, the script evolved a bit by bit. He got busy and made some films and until eventually the time was right, you know.
Yeah.
And then we sent it to Aaron and the rest is history.
Because this beautiful friendship had begun already on The Outlaw King.
That's right. Yeah.
Which is, so you guys first met, what, 9 years ago or so?
No, that's going to be longer than that.
10?
Outlaw King.
When's Outlaw King?
It came out 2017.
9 years. Absolutely. I mean, it's always wonderful to get that call from a director you worked before and had a wonderful experience. Like Outlaw King, you know, was really informative and I had a lot of growth on that as in terms of like acting and learning. And I learned so much under Mackenzie, because he allowed, and he does this is his process, his style is to kind of create this wild, chaotic environment and then just use an actor if you feel comfortable in your character, like, you know, you just let you run and go, and it is an immersive experience and feeling. And I think it really filters out some actors who don't feel comfortable, you know, and it really means that you got to go do your prep, you do your work, so that there's not a moment where you can get lost, because he might not cut for a while, you know, and just see what happens, you know. And but that exciting thing of like feeling like going beyond what was on the page is always like, there's this exciting area, you know, there's this gray area that can go, it's spontaneity happens.
Yeah.
Happy accidents happen. But just jump back to like the, how this kind of story came about. Yeah. Like, I mean, that was one of the other things what drew me to it was that you had this passion, this idea, you and Ben, like, been thinking about Hurt Locker was inspiration. Then it was like French 70s, like heist movies, like Alain Delon movies, like, Robbie, can I get away with it? What goes into that? And then shooting it in London, sort of putting it in London. And then just the idea though, that this concept, and this is really rare, this came straight came to me after the writer's strike, right?
Okay.
And I was just, you know, we were all very in a place of like, where's, you know, we need our writers, we need creativity, we need originality. Yeah. And I think something like this came from an idea of a film, a director and a writer. And it wasn't an IP. It wasn't from a book, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't from a book. It wasn't from a graphic novel or anything. It's just like, it's really original and kind of going to see if we can do this mashup and kind of see how that happens.
Yeah.
And does it keep the stakes going? And then the characters around that, how do they kind of come about? So it's, that's an exciting way of just like movie making. And I was just really involved and inspired by like that and drawn to that as well. You know,
it's an exercise in genre, David. I mean, I was talking to Theo about this yesterday because I talked to him for the podcast as well. And we're talking about the fact that we know very little about the characters for the first 30 to 40 minutes. Sometimes we don't even know character names. And so it feels like an exercise in how much an audience can imprint upon characters and become infested in characters, having been given very little information other than this life and death situation that they're dealing with.
What's interesting is you try and feather in little bits of detail, you know, like for example, the scene where he prepares the, you know, the drinks and you have to infer There's a whole bunch of history behind his eyes, you know, and you get that. But the challenge of having a kind of real time narrative where you really don't have time to you know, throw some big backstory in there or whatever, you know, so you're living in the moment, and then with your cast trying to kind of build those characters up and get a sense of who they are with that very limited material. And there's something really interesting about that. And actually, it's always easier than you think, because I think audiences do kind of like, you know, it sort of try and work their way through and imprint, you know, things on those characters when you're kind of engaged in action based off, you know.
So, yeah, I also think, you know, like reading something like this, we were like, and it was a page turner, like, you know, David sent it to me and I was like, mate, this is like, it's super exciting. And also like, but you're like, if you know, it's such a kind of high concept in itself, this kind of idea that this could be, could it be possible? Does that happen a lot? And, you know, and then we went, well, we're going to get in touch with some military experts and police and EOD specialists and kind of dig a little bit deeper and kind of see how much we can, like, how far, you know, does this all plot and work out?
They really helped us because they affirmed that these things are. I mean, that, you know, the second world bomb is discovered kind of almost every year in a building site in London, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there are, the police have particular protocols and the army have protocols, you know.
Wasn't it like we read it and then like a few months, 6 months later, like there was one that was found in like Exmouth.
Exeter.
It was in Exeter.
Well, I mean, there's one found in Belfast, there's several found in London, there's one found on the railway tracks outside Paris. You know, Ben lives in Berlin. They phone in Berlin. You know, it's the sort of shadows of the Second World War.
Yeah, no, it was this kind of interesting kind of thing. And then it just kind of informed, like, oh, that's kind of wild that this, you know. And then what would be the protocols? Then we'd have evacuation. Then we'd have this. This would happen. Then that would go. And then kind of crazy details, like, you know. And then we'd ask the police. It's like, right, we want 20 pizzas. And you go, you'd want 20 pizzas. So how does that help the? And they go, because we're hungry. You go, oh, right, yeah. So you get the police to go get your visas, and you'll be like, concierge, be like, yeah, that's all. And you're like, just remind them that, you know, we're the military and like, we've got something big to do, you know?
Yeah. And he's got some booze with him as well, right? So he comes prepared to this.
Yeah.
There's an element of irregularity to those guys. They, you know, they're incredibly brave and put themselves in harm's way and so maybe the normal rules don't fully apply, you know.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting. You pull, you know, you do these things. I think it comes out of an idea, right? An artist's idea, and then you kind of go, you know, how plausible are these things? And you start exploring and go, well, this is what we're doing. By the way, I found one not too long ago, and my mate got called out to do it, and this is what he did. And you're like, this is mad. Yeah. Wait, what?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then, like, you know, our guy Nick Orr, who's our EOD specialist, was in the military, and now he's in privatized, you know, organizations and going over there in the front lines at the moment. Do you know what I mean? So he's seeing so many other things that are happening, you know what I mean? And you take your expertise and all these other stuff. So it's really extraordinary. It really informs certain ideas and characters anyway. You get into it and then, you know, and then at the end of the day, we want to make an entertaining heist movie. But
absolutely.
The point is that we goo-goo, you know, me, Sam, you know, we all have to go deep in and do our homework and do our work. And then, you know, you get to have fun.
And then let it flow.
Let it flow. Yeah.
Did you base him on anyone, Aaron, in particular? Because again, you're very good with the accents. This is another accent for you to add to your collection.
Yeah, Nick, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's our consultant guys. There's a lot, like, you know, and then, you know, but then also just kind of wanted, I can't even remember where I paced it, up north, I think it was, remember if it was Leeds or Sheffield or something, I don't remember where. It was kind of a specific.
He's a real shapeshifter, so, you know, it's really interesting watching. I think it's, you know, like,
I just don't want him to be based in London, I just wanted to, you know, but it was kind of interesting because I came on and then Theo had already come in and he was like, well, he's South African, isn't it? And then he was like, oh, wow, it was kind of. But then it's like, that's the thing, that's the brilliance of London and the you know, the world. It's just, it's not, doesn't have to, it has to feel diverse and, you know, international and feels like what's, you know.
When was the last time you used your own accent?
I will never. Because
the first time
I
met you was on Kick-Ass and you were already doing accents then.
I would never feel, I'm not a person who doesn't feel ultimately, I don't feel comfortable in my own skin on camera. Like, this is like, I find this is a whole new thing I have to learn, you know?
Yeah. You could do an accent for this and just know it. Yeah.
I could. And back in the day, I used to actually. No, I think, you know, it's just that, yeah, the joy of being able to do what I do is like you want to. It starts with it's so many things. It's the physicality. It's the voice. Mm-hmm. It's like the hobby, the habits and everything. And you start to find that you got to, you know, I like to be immersed in a character and sort of feel it. Otherwise, I don't know how to switch in a bit.
Okay,
you know.
But your voice is really important to you. And I remember on I Looking, you know, because you know, he was playing James Douglas, he had a battle cry, which is to remind his enemies of his name. And so he'd go, Douglas. And I hear Aaron in the distance of the sets, you know, like you know, shouting that out and kind of which is, you know, a combination of voice and character, you know, so you channel that and turn that into your advantage.
And the funny thing is, like, it's nice to be told those things because I totally forget as well. Like, I'm so like I go into a space and then and then the moment the thing's finished, it like I have to shed it and go away from it. And then you kind of go, wow, I was
and then 2 years later, someone asks you questions about
my mind, you know, or like, you know,
tell
my,
me about this specific day. Like,
yeah, that was kind of difficult. whoever that person was, that was weird.
I would never do that. So tell me about the specific days you spent shooting, because I think we can say that there's quite a lot of film is spent in that building site trying to defuse this World War II bomb. And what was that like for you both, you know, filming those scenes? Were you desperate to get out of that site at the end of it all?
I was definitely desperate to get out of that site by the end of it. It was it was also, you know,
ready to demolish,
it was very, very noisy. It was, you know, and
where was it?
It was sort of it was a parking lot in Wembley, you know what I mean?
Okay.
And we built an amazing set. It was very three-dimensional, but it was not the most pleasant of places to be, you know.
It was really intense. I mean, we were, what did we speak? Spend 1 week or 2 weeks almost?
I think it was 10 days. Probably 10 days.
10 days, yeah. I think.
Yeah. Okay.
I had 14 days on this, shooting days. For whatever reason, you know, it was all back to back. But then that was almost in the middle of the movie, almost, because you had shot Theo stuff at the beginning and Gugu, and then it was near the end or the middle.
It was the second half.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's interesting because, like you said, it kind of the tension, the speed of it, and the informed quite a lot of what else was going on. And you know, you're speaking into comms to people that you've already shot and things like that. And I think it's that in itself is a challenge, coming to something and kind of going, almost shooting it back to front, and not like, you know, and you're, and I think, and also you've got another energy because of what was beautiful about each character is in their world, you're immersed in their world, like you're in Google's world, you're in Theo's world, you're in my world, and then it's like how these all mash up and collide. So it is interesting. And it became a bit like, I would say that construction site became a bit of our stage because of the choreography and the blocking of what needs to happen, the protocol of like this now needs to happen and this goes off and then that happens. And this would, you know, there's a lot of sort of practicalities around what would really happen in a situation like that, and also how to keep the tension going. And so it was a challenge. It was difficult, but
it was very concentrated, which is good, you know. And we were mostly sequential.
We were sequenced. Our construction in sequence, didn't we? Of like continuity on stuff. We'd come back to the next day, and if a building was down or this, or you know, so we worked with that, and that was quite great, I think. And also like, does this jacket come off and then that thing, your sleeves get rolled, you know, continuity, silly stuff like that. But, you know, you've got to get back in the mindset and how dirty you are, whatever's going on, you know what I mean? It's
On that note, guys, always a pleasure. Aaron, David, thanks so much indeed. Thanks for having us on, man.
Appreciate it.
Okay, that was Aaron Taylor-Johnson and David McKenzie talking about Fuse with a Said. And now it's time for the reviews with a Said section of the show, talking about the films that are out in the multiplexes this week and on your Sofaplex as well. Jimbo.
Hello.
Let's start with Fuse, shall we? What are your views on Fuse?
I refuse to talk about Fuse.
Thank God.
There we go.
Helen, what are your views on Fuse? No, Jimbo, you go.
Yes, You've already heard from Aaron Taylor-Johnson and David McKenzie, but this is a heist movie in which a construction site in the middle of London all grinds to a halt when they discover an unexploded World War II bomb, a 500-pound bomb, which is big, big bomb, big,
big bomb,
big bada boom, big bada boom.
Little damage.
And as, of course, that they have to evacuate, you know, loads of streets around the bomb, something like 900 metres, whatever it is.
800
like
metres.
800 metres, there we go. And 800 metres in every direction has to be evacuated. But of course, there is a gang waiting to do a robbery, and they use this distraction. So under the cover of bomb disposal, they burrow into a bank vault to steal shit that isn't theirs, because that's how robberies work.
Yes.
If it was stuff that was theirs, then frankly this would have been overkill.
Dishonest misappropriation of property belonging to another with intention permanently to deprive.
Look at that, the legal definition.
Legal
it's
definition
almost
of theft.
Like you were trained as a barrister.
There you go.
Anyway, yes, so this is a team led by Theo James, and you can tell it's Theo James because he's South African and he speaks with a South African accent or a close approximation of one.
No, I think it's a pretty good South African accent myself.
Diplomatic immunity. Yes, while they're trying to stop the bomb from going off, the heist is going on and things happen. It's a heist movie, but I think the main thing I took away from this is that it is no Den of Thieves 2 Pantera.
Oh, good Lord.
Well, very few films are.
Very few films are.
Including Rafifi.
Indeed. It's kind of fun. It's got a propulsive kind of tension to it early on when you are waiting to see what's going to happen with the big bada boom. There is a framing of some of the characters that doesn't come until the third act, which I found a very odd turn, a very odd way of structuring a film that is not based on a true story. Because it had the hint of something that was based on fact. And because it wasn't, I don't know why you would structure it that way. I don't want to spoil it, but that, I mean, it threw me.
It's an exercise in genre. I talked about this with David McKenzie. It's an idea of you have very little information about any of these characters for the longest time. And can you, as an audience member, become involved in their stories despite not even knowing their names sometimes?
And I think that's fine, but it expects you to do a kind of, I guess, a sympathetic contortion in the final act of the movie, which just felt a little bit weird to me.
Yeah.
So when it ended, I was just like, huh.
I mean, I had fun watching it, but it is very silly, ultimately.
It's very, very silly.
It starts off quite serious and then gets very, very silly. And that was okay by me because I just watched Super Mario and I, you know, that was all right. But it is, and it's silly to the point where over the credits they do a sort of where are they now for some of these fictional characters.
With gags.
And I was just like, what is happening? Why do we care? This is so weird.
Why do we have this and why are there random gags in it? It's a really odd choice.
But at that point I was just like, oh, you're just being silly. You're having fun.
Yeah.
Well done, everybody. I quite enjoyed the heist. We talked about competence porn the other week. Like, they are pretty competent thieves. There's some moments where they could have, like, thought things through better, but there are moments of real, we have a plan and here we are doing it,
but
and I quite enjoyed
not
that.
Not Ocean's level heist porn. Like,
no,
it's quite,
no.
You know, they're not bumbling, like they're journeyman thieves.
But they managed to stay ahead of, you know, Gugu Mbatha-Raw is the sort of head of the police who's in control of this whole evacuation, trying to contain this whole problem. I enjoyed it. Do I think it's good? I'm not sure if it's good, but I had fun.
Yeah, you don't get bored.
No.
Like, it's quite...
It's 90-ish
minutes.
Yeah,
it's an easy-ish kind of fun watch that you will instantly forget about and never revisit.
I thought it was a good thriller. It's got lots of twists and turns lots of stuff going on and character reversals and unexpected developments and some developments that might be expected, but, you know, they're pulled off with a little bit of panache and I enjoyed all the performances. I like Aaron Taylor-Johnson's ongoing commitment to doing every accent in the British Isles and and some outside as well. I like Theo James's commitment just randomly to be in South African.
Theo James?
Yes, that's right, James. Thank you. We talk about it in the interview I did with him, why he decided to go South African. It was a very late in the day development, I think, for him. I think he's South African. So that's good. I think Gugu's a bit wasted.
Yes,
movie.
Very much so. She's better than that role.
Yeah. I do wonder if there's a lot of stuff cut from this movie. It's structurally, it's really interesting. I'm trying to set up an interview with David McKenzie so we can talk about this film unfettered by a fear of spoiler. And because there are questions I would like to have answered. Answer them, goddammit! But I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good time at the movies. And Once Upon a Time, of course, the most terrifying four words in the English language were a Sky Cinema original. No longer, I think, is that the case. They're getting their act together slowly but surely, and this is another step in the right direction.
I enjoyed it, but I very much felt that it was a Sky Cinema original.
I very much feel you're a Sky Cinema original.
Hey, look, if you love a heist movie, if you enjoy a heist, then Den of Thieves 2 Pantera is streaming and available now.
And if you like a heist, then Den of Thieves is also streaming.
And even better.
Can I recommend just watching no other movies except those two? I mean,
so many other movies, guys.
Well, yes.
Like so many.
Like the Princess Bride and Aliens and Evil Dead 2. I'm begging
Dune.
Us, see more movies for the love of God.
Seymour. Little Shop of Horrors.
Yes. Suddenly Seymour.
But even Ocean's 11, we've just mentioned it. Like, just out of heist movies. Alone.
Yeah, but I've only read the Wikipedia entry.
Oh, boy.
I don't know anything about the actual film. Here, there's a great sequel, Ocean's 12. But there we go. We gave this one three stars then for Fuse with a said. Next up, Helen, Le Drama.
Drama! This is the new film from Christopher Borgli, who made Sick of Myself back in 2022, Dream Scenario, the one with Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, good film.
The following year, and now this. So this is Zendaya and Robert Pattinson as a couple who are about to get married. You know, everything looks perfect on the outside. They are very much in love. They're crazy about each other. And then they go out with their besties, Mamadou Athi and Alana Haim, about a week before the wedding. And they talk about how they shared the worst thing they'd ever done before they got married and how this was very freeing and sort of, you know, it helped them come closer. So they all decide to do this.
Oh, no.
And
don't do that.
Zendaya's Emma says something that basically shocks them all and puts her entire relationship with Charlie, the Robert Pattinson character, into a new light. And he has to kind of, well, he basically begins to spiral and starts wondering, you know, do I know this person at all? What am I marrying into? You know, what does this mean? Blah, 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 blah.
Wow.
So it's essentially, and she also is somewhat spinning out because, you know, now these people close to her know about this great secret that she had, and she's trying to deal with the aftermath of that as well and also kind of process it maybe in a way that she hasn't maybe before. This is a very hard one to talk about because you can find out the spoiler if you want.
It's out there.
Don't. I would very much recommend against it. It has been controversial. Some people see it as making light of something you shouldn't make light of. I don't think the film is doing that, but I do think it is. It's not as funny a thing as I thought this was going to be. I thought it was going to be shocking and weird, but not quite as upsetting as it is. And that did make this a sort of a harder watch than I had anticipated, you know, because I'd just seen the trailer and I knew she was going to say something that everybody was shocked by, but I didn't know what. So I just kind of assumed it was going to be a different kind of shock than it in fact is. And I think that some people are going to, and some people in fact already have, hated the film for the revelation.
It got no stars in the Boston Globe.
Right, there
you go. No stars.
Well, that's drama.
And I don't think it is making light of the thing. And I think it is kind of engaging with that in a sort of interesting way. Sounds dismissive, but it is engaging that in a thoughtful way. But at the same time, it's a really hard thing for your even black comedy to get past. That is a big ask, and I'm not sure that for me it 100% did. I think tonally it was a very weird film as a result. But look, it is an independent film. This is not trying to be My Best Friend's Wedding.
No,
you know, it is trying to be a very sort of stranger film than that. This is another A24, so it's definitely playing in that sort of space. Ari Aster is one of the producers, so that should have you on alert for
what's the worst thing you've ever done? Beau is Afraid.
I mean, you're not wrong. Anyway.
We love him.
We don't maybe love Beau is Afraid. The point is, I think it is a very difficult sort of thing to balance, and I'm not 100% sure that this film 100% does. Having said that, I thought the performances by these two were off the charts.
Oh, career best, both of them.
Particularly Robert Pattinson, who I thought was absolutely stunning. I think I expected it to be Zendaya's film, and I actually think it's his film. I think he's really, really brilliant in this. And it's, if you're a fan, or even if you're not a fan, I mean, it's time to, I think, get over not being a fan. And you know, yes, he was in Twilight, and I'm sure you don't like it, but I'm also sure you haven't seen it.
I don't think he was wild about it either.
And I don't think he's wild about it either. And he is genuinely, I think, a great actor. Yeah. I love them in this. But I, as a film, I'm a little bit more hesitant.
I love this film, absolutely love it. And I think the discomfort you talk of, I mean, it is deliberate, right? Like, it's that particular revelation is chosen specifically for the discomfort, because this whole film is built on a foundation of discomfort. It's about making you feel as uncomfortable as possible. I have a personal sensitivity to cringe humor and cringe sequences and any kind of Fremdschämen or vicarious embarrassment. And there is a speech in this where I honestly think I folded in upon myself and became a singularity. I cringed so hard. It was so excruciating. My mind just stopped being able to process it. I literally, at several points in this film, had to close my eyes and pretend to be somewhere else because I couldn't deal with it. But I really, really enjoyed this film regardless. And that's saying quite a lot because I really, really hate cringe stuff. But I thought the performances were fantastic. I love that it makes you so uncomfortable. And I think it's so perfectly pitched as something that doesn't sound ridiculous, but makes you squirm in your seat because you don't know quite how you're supposed to feel or how you're supposed to deal with it. And the fallout of everything that comes afterwards feels incredibly real because, like, the other characters don't know how to deal with it either. And the way that scene is delivered and the way she's so offhand about it, you're just like, you're almost like, the characters look at each other for a moment and they're like, and they laugh nervously. And you as the audience feel very much the same way. And
I cannot wait to see this movie now because I was excited anyway, but I want to know what the fuck this is.
And you know, you won't ruin the film if you do know what it is, but I would suggest not, because you want to be in that moment with those characters.
Yeah, very much so.
And it's beautiful. I'm not surprised it's very controversial. I'm not surprised that it has pushed a lot of people's buttons and people have reacted sort of violently against it. But personally, I think it's great.
All right. Exciting stuff. We gave this one 4 stars. 4 stars then for the drama. Speaking of the worst thing that people have ever done, brings us neatly to the Super Mario Galaxy movie. The first movie was so bad. Flames in the side of my face. Just a kind of insulting, mindless dreck that people usually assume is served up to kids. And kids' movies and most animated movies are many, many levels beyond that. I assume, James, that for the Super Mario Galaxy movie, which obviously the first one made, the Super Mario Brothers movie, made over $1 billion, and people, just kids and families, just devoured it. But I'm sure that lessons have been learned, and this movie is a course correcting steer towards pure cinema.
That is exactly what has happened. directors Aaron Horvath and Michael Jelenic have created, I think, masterpiece.
The singularity.
Is a word you could use. But let's talk about language for a little bit and the meanings of words. So let's take, for example, the word hateful. Hateful is a word that you could use, and you could apply it to something like this. Because the problem with this film is, it is so creatively bankrupt. It is so cynical. It is so life force sappingly tedious that I honestly, there were parts where I felt like I was going out of my... I was sitting next to Helen. I think we both had this. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was having an out-of-body experience. And I am someone for whom this film should be appealing because I like Mario. I play the games. I know the stories. I've played Super Mario Galaxy many, many times because this is loosely based on that. We should say, from a story point of view,
need to know.
I mean,
we don't.
Sure, you're sure. Brie Larson plays another princess, Rosalina, and she is abducted by Bowser Jr. Uh-huh. And
Benny Safdie.
Right, and they team up with
Yoshi.
Played by Donald Glover. And then, oh my God, Glenn Powell turns up as Fox McCloud from the Star Fox games. So there's a lot of Nintendo IP farming going on here.
Are there Pikmin in it? I don't know who they are, but somebody told me.
There are a few other quite, you know, which I won't spoil, little Nintendo nods in there. There are lots of lovely little musical cues. There are sort of 8-bit and 16-bit graphical sequences to kind of nod to the original Super Mario Brothers game. And
that sounds
good.
And the Super Nintendo version. Like, there's lots of... So if you play the games, there are a lot of things you'll recognise. So, and so, like I say, I recognised all that stuff. My nostalgia bones were tickled, and I still wanted to set my own face on fire while watching this, because I'm not even kidding. And I'm not... You know, genuinely, this film made me so angry, because it has no ideas. It has no real jokes. The dialogue is non-existent. I mean, there's very little dialogue in it. It's just... I think you said this in your review, Helen. This is just stuff happening for no particular reason, and you almost certainly won't remember why or what happened. It's just things, colourful things going around the screen. And if someone had told me this had been created entirely by AI, I would believe them. There's no feeling of human creativity to this. It's 100% cynical IP farming by the numbers. And so it made me cross. Very cross.
The first movie made me cross as well, because those directors directed Teen Titans Go to the Movies, which is
delightful.
Fun and delightful and subversive and inventive and IP farms in a really, really interesting way. And the first movie was inert and unfunny and looked great, I have to say. I understand why parents would bring their kids to this. It's a very easy thing to do, to go along and here's the bright, shiny film. But the fact that this movie is going to make in one weekend what Hoppers has
and
made
it
in its totality is really, really depressing. I say that, of course, I haven't seen this movie, and I'll be honest, I never will. But there are so many great animated movies out there. There are so many great inventive animated movies out there that this one was so huge was really dismaying to me. Helen, talk me off the ledge, please.
Honestly, I don't know that I can. I thought I was going to be the, you know, negative one, and then James came in and with even bigger boots. I freely admit I am not a hardcore Mario fan. I have been in the room while people have played it. I myself am not a gamer, right? So even the little nostalgia buzz, I recognize that those are little musical cues from the games, but I don't have any particular emotional connection to that. So I wasn't even getting those tiny little serotonin bumps, you know? I was just sitting there just going, why is this? There are so many bits in this film where they will just stop and look at something or stop and strike a pose. And again, the poses may well be from games or covers of games or something. But like, there was just, there's all these sort of pauses that I guess you're meant to feel something, but you don't feel anything. And I really cannot stress enough that this is not funny.
No,
and there
at all.
There is nothing in this movie even as good as Peaches, the song in the first movie. There's nothing as weird or as human as that. It's just there on the screen. And look, you're going to have to take your kids to see it because they're going to want to go see it. If you have kids, I know my small niece and nephew are going to be going to see it because they're excited about it.
Just lie to them. Tell them Hoppers is Super Mario Galaxy movie and take them to see Hoppers instead. Or better still, Scream 7.
I mean, on Project Hail Mary is almost okay for small children.
Yeah,
almost. You know, but
it feels like they just thought, what is the absolute bare minimum we can do to hoover up all the money connected to this IP, and that's the film.
Yeah, I don't know why. Like, Nintendo seem to be, you know, they've always been very careful about protecting their IP, certainly from anybody trying to, you know, rip off their copyright. I don't know why they would sign off on this either, because I don't see how it helps people love Super Mario anymore.
It has a stacked cast as well. Like, presumably
they're
such
all
a waste.
Fans. But like, you can't, if we hadn't told you that that was Donald Glover and Benny Safdie.
Yeah, you'd have no idea.
I would challenge you to recognize who was who. I genuinely think, I don't think you can tell. And I'm not sure of the point of celebrity stunt casting if you're then processing their voices to sound more like the video games, I guess, or something. What are you allowing them to bring to the table? Donald Glover is an incredibly charismatic, musically gifted, acting gifted person. What have you allowed him to bring to Yoshi here? I genuinely could not answer.
Use
that.
The Stanislavski method.
And look, if this funds like 16 art projects that he has going on, God bless him.
Yeah.
But I don't know even what's in it for the studio. What are we doing here? Anyway.
We're reviewing films and we're giving this one 2 stars.
I'd flirted with one.
Yeah, it's one of these things. It's probably a two. You want to give it a one just to be punitive because it's so cynical and so infuriating. But it probably scrapes a two for the simple reason that, depressingly, young kids are probably just going to lap this up and have a really good time.
Ah, oh, dearie me. Two stars then for some. It's a more depressing review than I expected. Two stars then for the Super Mario Galaxy movie. Last but not least, this week, Hell's Bells, we have an original movie!
Woohoo! It can be done! I mean, we did also have Fuse and the drama.
Oh, we've had three original movies! Dun, 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 dun. And this one is called Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice.
Correct.
It's on Disney Plus right now. Tell us about it, Helen O'Hara.
So this is directed by Ben David Grabinski, who worked on Coyote versus Acme, which we sadly still haven't seen here, among other things, obviously. But this is a time travel gangster comedy, I guess, is about the best way to sum it up.
Yeah.
So Mike is a disillusioned hitman whose best friend is Nick. Mike is played by James Marsden. Nick is Vince Vaughn. And Mike is also having an affair with Nick's wife, Alice.
He's stooping.
Isaac Gonzalez.
Yes.
And then other Nick from the future comes back to tell them that basically things are afoot. And essentially it becomes clear that Mike is maybe going to die tonight, and Nick's...
Future Nick.
Well, yes, both Nicks are going to have to try and keep him alive, says yes. Future Nick.
Future Nick, and then present Nick is not meant to be a part of this.
No.
But he comes into it, and there are complications and all sorts of stuff. And yes. So it's about both Nicks and Alice and Mike trying to keep Mike alive.
Yes, and it has... I mean, the title is kind of the movie. Like, it is very much about these four people. You also do have good supporting roles, little sort of comedy supporting roles for, like, Keith David, Jimmy Tatro, Stephen Root. All these people turn up.
Ben Schwartz.
Tiny roles for, like, Arturo Castro and Louis Tan, who are sort of two of the upcoming, like, you know, comedy guys you see in stuff who are good in stuff, you know? I just had a really nice time with this. I think the less we tell you about the plot, the better. And, The shifting kind of dynamics between these three people who all have very complicated feelings for one another. They all love each other very much, but also maybe have cause for, you know, some anger with each other at times, I think is great. I just really liked how weird and different and unexpected it was, and I had a lovely time.
Yeah, very much so. I echo that entirely. This is... You know, there's lots of different bits of movies floating around in here, but they are fused with an S together winningly, I would say, by Grabinski. There's one little weird stylistic choice he makes where he has kind of very blurry slow-mo going on in quite a lot of the action scenes, which is a slightly odd choice that took me out of some of the action scenes. But otherwise, they're staged really, really well and shot very inventively. And that chief quartet, if you will, of James Marsden and Isaac Gonzalez and Vince Vaughn are just having an absolute blast. Yeah. And the scenes with Vaughn and Vaughn are unexpected and even touching in ways that I think you won't expect. This is really good. I really enjoyed it. It's one of those little movies that sneaks on to Disney Plus with very little fanfare, despite having a pretty starry cast, and reminded me a little bit, although I didn't flip for it as much as I flipped for last year's Eenie Meenie, but I did really, really like this one. So check it out, Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice, if you have a Disney Plus subscription, or if you're listening to this in the United States of America, hello, thank you for joining us across the Atlantic. Hulu is the place that you can watch this movie, and there are lots of surprises. Wouldn't mind doing a spoiler special in this one, but we shall see how that one goes. I don't think we've got an Empire review yet.
Not yet. I think it's like high three, low four for me, somewhere in there.
Yeah, I would say that. High three, low four. A good time will be had by all, is what I'm saying about Mike and Nick and Nick and Alice. And on that note,
That is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll be joined by James McAvoy, who is stepping into the director's chair for the first time with California Schemin. And he came into the studio and we had a good old natter about that and a great many things. So that was exciting. Nice. Very exciting indeed. But until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from my two colleagues of such lethal cunning. Goodbye, James.
Bye, Chris.
Yeah, goodbye. Goodbye to you, Helen O'Hara.
Toodaloo.
Toodaloo. And it is goodbye from me. I am off to fulfill the ancient prophecy to make something happen that I promised would happen at the beginning of the episode. They said it couldn't be done, but it shall be done. James, Helen, hug. Hug. They're not moving. Hug.
Don't touch me.
Hug.
Never touch me.
You just keep saying it. It's
trying
weird.
To move you with the force. It turns out the force doesn't exist. Oh, fuck it. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.